You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Ippi.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with Jane Kinnaman from Chatham House. Top of the agenda, more than 2 million people have now fled Syria.
Also on the program, we'll be in the South Pacific to find out why some island nations are on the verge of being wiped out by rising sea levels.
Plus,
風を翼を震わせてあなたのもとへ届きませ。
A scene there from the upcoming animated film The Wind Rises. We look back on the career of Hayao Miyazaki, who announced his retirement from cinema.
And we'll be in Belgrade to find out what new design from architect Zaha Hadid has the potential to radically transform the city.
What we're trying to do is actually to reform the banks of the river, because we have two amazing rivers and it's just unbelievable how unused they are.
All that plus we'll review this morning's front pages from Italy, and we may even play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy 60 minutes coming up ahead here on Midori House, but before all that, here is Paul Osborne with the world headlines.
The United Nations says 2 million people have now fled the conflict in Syria, double the number of refugees just 6 months ago. The UN's refugee agency says it's vital the conflict is stopped before it spills over into other countries, causing an explosion in the Middle East. Inside Syria, it's thought another 5 million people have been displaced. Around one in three refugees are in Lebanon. Sam Tarif is a coordinator trying to help them.
The problem now is we have no more apartments to rent, no cheap kind of small rooms in the Palestinian refugee camps in Beirut or in small villages in Bekaa or wherever. So currently what we are doing is we are giving people a tent and food baskets.
The U.S. Defense Secretary and Secretary of State will lobby Congress later ahead of a vote next week on possible military action against Syria. Yesterday, President Obama met senior senators to try to win their support for strikes. But Republican Lindsey Graham still skeptical.
At the end of the day, this is a Syrian fight, but the outcome does not limit itself to Syria. So we let it be known to the president that we don't want endless war.
Microsoft has agreed to buy the mobile phone business of the Finnish firm Nokia. The deal is worth more than $7 billion and will see more than 30,000 employees transfer to Microsoft next year. Nokia was once the market leader in mobile phones, but has struggled to compete with Apple and Samsung. Nokia's latest phones already run Microsoft's Windows Phone software. Brazil and Mexico have summoned the U.S. ambassadors to their countries over allegations that their leaders have been spied on. Leaked files suggest the National Security Agency illegally monitored their communications. Brazil has warned any such action would be a serious breach of sovereignty. The Japanese government is to spend almost $500 million securing the Fukushima nuclear plant. It follows confirmation that radioactive water is still leaking from the site 2.5 years after it was crippled by an earthquake and tsunami. Officials say the cleanup operation will take decades to complete. Monocle's Fiona Wilson is in Tokyo.
To keep the plant under control, they are pouring massive amounts of water to keep it cool. And the water is being stored in tanks. And, you know, eventually they're going to have to do something with this water. And at the moment there are leaks. There have been all sorts of problems that have been revealed in a rather piecemeal and haphazard way over the last few weeks.
China has sacked the head of its state assets regulator 2 days after it emerged he was under investigation for allegations of corruption. Jiang Zemin is suspected of serious discipline violations, according to Chinese state TV. That's the language normally used for bribery. Unions in South Africa say 80,000 gold miners will begin a strike over pay later today. They're demanding a 60% pay rise for new recruits. Mine owners insist they can't afford that because of falling gold prices. It's the latest in a series of disputes over pay. as the value of South Africa's currency continues to slide. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul. It is 5 minutes past the top of the hour, 16:05 in Tokyo, 10:05 a.m. in Helsinki, and 8:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. It's time now to set the day's news agenda with the stories you'll need to know today for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today in the studio is Jane Kinnamon. She's a senior research fellow in the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House, the London-based Policy Research Institute. Jane, welcome to the program. Let's begin on some quite sobering news out of Syria. An important milestone has been passed. 2 million refugees now because of the conflict.
That's right. The UN has said that there are 2 million Syrian refugees outside the country and also 5 million internally displaced people. So 7 million in total, making it the world's biggest refugee crisis. And the UN's calling it the humanitarian disaster of the century.
We talked about this on today's edition of The Globalist already, and it's the neighbouring country, Lebanon, that has actually been getting a huge number of refugees from Syria. How do you see the future? How is Lebanon coping with all these people?
Well, Lebanon's tiny. It's just under 5 million Lebanese people. So the numbers that have entered Lebanon mean that now 1 in 7 people in Lebanon is a Syrian refugee. That's the registered refugees. It doesn't include the wealthy, the middle class, who have just taken their families to Beirut without registering themselves as refugees. By some estimates, 25% of Lebanon's population will be Syrian refugees by the end of the year. And of course, these are Syrians on both sides of the civil war. So it adds to the potential for conflict in Lebanon itself.
Well, it is raising the concept that there could be exposed sectarian violence in Lebanon because of these refugees from both sides.
The conflict in Syria is already spilling over into Lebanon, and you've seen car bombings in the past month, both seemingly targeted against Hezbollah and then on Friday targeted at Sunni mosques in the northern city of Tripoli. So there might well be a sectarian element to that, but it's not yet clear, you know, who exactly is responsible, whether refugees can be blamed or not. But there will be a sense, as there is in Iraq, that the refugees might pose a security risk.
Go ahead. And it's quite important, I guess, to also keep this in mind, this figure of 2 million, but some 1 million of these 2 million refugees who have fled are children. Quite a startling number there. Some three quarter of that number, 750,000, are under the age of 11. As the West kind of debate whether or not to intervene militarily in Syria with those strikes, if there indeed is military strikes in the coming days or weeks, how much will this refugee problem be exacerbated?
You could well have further outflows of people fleeing Western airstrikes. They're bound to cause casualties. And also, if you're living in Syria, if you do watch any of the state media, they'll be massively whipping up fear about what an American bombing campaign could do. So certainly it could get worse. And the international community, divided as they are over war, they should at least be able to pull together to try to help the neighbouring countries cope with the refugees. It shouldn't be that divisive or that difficult an issue, but it needs more attention.
How would you evaluate the attitude in Lebanon at the moment when it comes to helping these people?
It really depends who you are. I think Lebanon is very divided over the conflict in Syria, but one thing is for certain, they're really afraid of their own civil war coming back to haunt them. And so far, Lebanon has been quite resilient. They've really tried to avoid the spillover from Syria, creating deep tensions within Lebanon itself, but it's something everyone's worried about. The UN has already started quietly evacuating staff. Several foreign governments have advised their nationals not to travel there. And there'll also be wealthy Lebanese people wondering if it's a good time to go and have an extended stay with families in Europe or the US.
And it isn't just Lebanon where these refugees are going. You're seeing huge amounts of refugees in places like Turkey, in Jordan, which currently has the largest refugee camp, the Zaadari refugee camp, with something like 130,000 refugees in the middle of the Jordanian desert. Yes. What strains are these refugees putting on other countries around the region?
Well, Turkey, Jordan, Iraq have all taken huge numbers. And, you know, the refugees problem isn't something new for the Middle East. Jordan in particular has faced these successive waves. I mean, around half of their population are displaced Palestinians. During the civil war in Iraq, they took in about 1 million Iraqis, and now these large numbers of Syrians. So there's a kind of chronic problem of people who get displaced for a very, very long time.
And as indeed, UN officials have been saying that this is now the worst ever refugee crisis we are seeing. Is there any hope that the UN would actually get more help with dealing with those refugees?
I think internationally, public opinion really should be putting more pressure on governments to help, because so far, aid has been such a secondary priority compared to this debate over military action and who's winning. Another thing that's interesting but sad is a lot of the charities like Oxfam, Save the Children and so on are saying that normal members of the public aren't donating. They turn away when they see Syria. It seems complicated. They don't want to think about it. So they've got less than half of the money that they need for their appeals.
Why has the situation in Syria not resonated with people in the West? Is it just they don't care? They don't want to think about it?
I think it's the complexity of the situation, which frankly is really complex for people who study it and follow it all the time. There's so many different accounts of what's going on. There's a huge propaganda war. So,
but why haven't aid agencies or people in the UN made it a very simple case? Because when we're talking about refugees, it shouldn't be a matter of what side they lie on. It's either they need aid, they need help. So why hasn't these aid agencies made a much simpler case?
It should be a simple issue, definitely. And you can see, for instance, here in London, adverts in the Tube saying refugees in Syria need blankets, very simple things. But I think because of the wider stories about the conflict, the uncertainty that people have, if you read the media, it's all a question of, you know, who's the good guy, who's the bad guy. People find it too complicated, but it shouldn't be the case.
Jane, shall we move to another news story from you, your third story, which is from Saudi Arabia, something that hasn't really been reported that much in English language. In Saudi Arabia, ever more human rights activists are on trial. What's going on over there?
That's right. I mean, there's quite a quiet clampdown on those Saudis who are trying to campaign for better human rights in their own country. And it's an interesting thing because when the Saudi government is criticised by the West or by Human Rights Watch or Amnesty, they typically say, well, these are Western standards. You know, this is not appropriate to judge our Islamic country in this way. But then when their own Saudi Muslim citizens try to be active on human rights, they face quite still severe repression.
But have you been noticing, perhaps, to be optimistic on the situation, a bit of a welcome news? And I say that because the country's just passed a new law banning domestic violence, and many people saying this is obviously going to help women in particular.
This is something really interesting, that the king has taken a few steps that have advanced the protection of women's rights. And this is definitely one of them. It's something that in the past has been controversial because there are some who claim that Islamic law allows a husband to beat his wife. And here you have Saudi Arabia saying, actually, it is illegal. Now, implementing that will take a much longer time. But still, as a principle, it's something quite important. But there is a big distinction between protecting women's rights, which is gradually improving from this pretty low base, and protecting people's political rights, freedom of speech and so forth, where we're seeing things going backwards.
So what have these activists, what have they tried to do?
There's a group called the Association for the Defence of Civil and Political Rights in Saudi Arabia, which has been trying to raise awareness of political prisoners, campaign for people not to be detained for long periods before trial, and they've been organising sit-ins and protests, which is very controversial. So their leader was detained for 10 years in December, and slowly other members are also being tried.
Thank you very much. That was Jane Kinnaman, Senior Research Fellow at Chatham House, the London-based Policy Research Institute.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much, Jane. In just a couple of minutes, we'll be heading to the South Pacific to find out why some island nations are fearing they're about to be washed out to sea.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
The Golden Leopard is the Locarno Film Festival's top prize, but it's not just the leopard print branding that sets this film festival apart. Since 1946, film lovers have been drawn to the unique mix of art and commerce at play in this Swiss mountain setting.
This is part of the spirit of Locarno, that directors talk about their craft rather than hearing a rooftop shouted mega deals. Is this emphasis on new, international art house a deliberate plan to weed out the hoi polloi and set Locarno apart? No. Locarno wants to be all about honouring cinema's rich history, discovering new talent, and doing business.
Robert Bound's report on the Locarno Film Festival is now showing in the films menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Ippi. The time is 19:17 in Suva, it's 18:17 in the Solomon Islands, and 8:17 here in London. Now, it's an area famous for its sandy white beaches, turquoise waters, and coral reefs, but give or take a few decades, and many of the islands in the South Pacific could be inundated with floodwaters or even worse, underwater.
The issue of climate change and rising sea levels is notably the top concern for leaders of Pacific island states, and this is one of the reasons they are currently meeting at the 44th Annual Pacific Islands Forum on the Marshall Islands. Well, joining us on the line to see what could come out of this meeting is our correspondent in Melbourne, Patrick Pittman. Patrick, welcome to the programme. Could you tell us about the main goals of this conference? Is it quite simply all about trying to make other countries realise how serious issue the global warming is for these island states?
It is. That's the main priority of this. I had a chat to Christopher Loyak, the president of the Marshall Islands, last month as they were planning this. And really for him, the priority is to have the major nations on the Pacific Rim, specifically Australia and the US, to have them step up and take some responsibility to think about the kinds of things they can do to help with the inevitable changes that are going to happen on islands like his. He's not talking anymore about how to stop this, but, you know, what to do.
And Patrick, you were just in Vanuatu quite recently for a story here for Monocle 24. Give us a sense on what the mood is like there in Vanuatu. Are you seeing people preparing for this so-called inundation of floodwaters that could be coming in the next couple of years, decades?
Look, Vanuatu is relatively well off in that sense because they do have a lot of high ground. But when you speak to the villagers, particularly in the coastal villages, you know, they're talking about already seeing effects and their agricultural patterns being changed and all of those things. And look, there are a lot of islands in Vanuatu, some of them higher, some of them lower. And, this is a real thing. The Pacific is obviously right there and it's not getting any lower.
And when it comes to these countries attending Pacific Islands Forum, how much unity is there in the end, considering that it's not just the small island states over there, it's also New Zealand and Australia participating?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting thing. The politics in the South Pacific are fraught in so many directions. There are the competing aid influences of Australia and China, largely, and then some vastly different politics between many of these islands, the Melanesian Islands, the Polynesian Islands. They all have very different political situations. Many of them are very unstable as well. So getting some sort of consensus on anything is always very tricky. But this is an issue where, you know, I think everybody is at least on the same page that something urgent needs to be done. So there is some hope that some sort of declaration will come out of this.
Absolutely. That declaration, which they're hoping to get, is the Maduro Declaration for Climate Leadership. But two, perhaps, of the biggest hurdles, as Mark has just mentioned, Australia and New Zealand there. Do you think it's likely that this declaration will pass, or will we see quite a lot of throwback from Australia and New Zealand?
Look, to be honest, I think Australia particularly doesn't really have its eye on this situation at the moment. I'm sure there are lots of people working within departments that are working really hard on this, and the public commitments have been there, but Australia is so deep in election mode that, you know, nobody's going to make any giant commitments on these things. And nobody wins any votes in Australia or New Zealand for really backing the Pacific Islands, and these issues are very fraught domestically as well. So look, they'll probably put the support behind it, but it's not going to be any sort of huge declaration.
So what would be the best possible outcome from this forum and from this meeting if they come up with some kind of an announcement? Do you think that is going to make a real difference to spark enough political momentum to actually make a change?
It would be nice to say so, but I think that's going to be different. I don't think it surprises anybody within outside of these islands to hear that they're going through these issues. Look, John Kerry gave them a video address today, and he said he was deeply concerned, but, you know, this is a video address and not much more. But what this will do is unify the Pacific Islands and maybe start in motion some sort of plan for really deeply considering the kinds of infrastructure changes they're going to need to think about, planning migration and those sorts of things. And that's what Christopher Loyak was talking about when I spoke to him about why he's driving this.
Is there a sense there from those Pacific Island leaders that, you know, perhaps things have gotten a bit too far away from them in terms of, you know, they just don't have enough time, really?
Well, that was exactly, it's always a tough question to put to somebody, but that's exactly what I asked President Loyak. How is it to be the president of an island that, you know, might not exist in a few years, these atolls that you grew up on? You know, he said that was deeply painful, and it was a tough thing to do. And, you know, he can't plan to fix it. As the Prime Minister of Vanuatu said when I spoke to him, he can't keep the water down. All he can do is plan for what comes. And I don't think anybody finds that easy there.
Patrick, thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House. Patrick Pittman, Monocle's man in Melbourne, soon to be, I think, Monocle's man in Montreal in just a couple of weeks as well. So we'll look forward to speaking to you there from Canada. Thanks for joining us here on the program.
ターレが風を見たでしょう。僕もあなたも見やしない。けれど木の葉を震わせて、風は通り抜けてゆく。風を翼を震わせて、あなたのもとへ届きませ。
This is one of the scenes from The Wind Rises, an upcoming animated film from the world-famous Japanese director Hayao Miyazaki.
Sad news, because it seems that this film will indeed be his last. Many fans are in disbelief by the announcement that Miyazaki is to retire at the young old age of 72. The revelation was made at a press conference at the Venice Film Festival, but no further details were given. There will be another press event in Tokyo a bit later, and the anime legend will want to say goodbye to all his fellow admirers.
Joining us now on the line is Dr. Reina Dennison, a Japanese cinema expert and lecturer at the University of East Anglia. Good morning and welcome to the program, Reina. How much do we know of the reasons why Miyazaki wants to retire now?
Well, this actually isn't the first time he's retired. He first retired back in 1997 or 98 after the release of Princess Mononoke. In fact, this has become something of a pattern for him. He always does this, or he's done this after Princess Mononoke and after Spirited Away, where In both cases, he was exhausted from the process of filmmaking and said he would never do another one. This time it's a little different, though, because this time the announcements come through the studio head, the studio president at Studio Ghibli. And what they've said is that Hayao Miyazaki won't be involved in future feature filmmaking, which means he will still be involved with the studio, hopefully, and will still be doing other kinds of jobs, but maybe not make another film himself.
How much do you think that this could even be perhaps a publicity stunt to raise a bit of awareness for his latest film, The Wind Rises?
Oh, almost inevitably. I think the interesting thing about this, you know, in terms of his last few films, is Miyazaki's films seem to me to be becoming ever more introspective and backwards-looking. And it's interesting this time that he's gone back to the Second World War and the Zero planes that were made in Japan for the Second World War, something that his own family was involved in, or at least his father was. So it's interesting how introspective he's becoming. I think, though, that we have to take this with a grain of salt, particularly as before the film was released, he said he was not going to retire. So I think we have to just take it with a little pinch of salt, maybe.
Just wait and
yeah.
See. Anyway, what is significant about him is his career. It's been said that he's possibly the only Japanese director that many Americans, for example, can name. What do you think? What is it about his work and his films that has resonated so much with the Western world?
Well, his films look beautiful, for a start, and the attention to the natural world and the attention to children, but within quite grown-up situations sometimes, I think is something that was very different for America, which had become so used to Disney and DreamWorks and the kind of shift to comedy animation. And that made his rather more serious animation seem to be very fresh and different. Most of the time when people talk about Studio Ghibli films as well, they talk about environmentalism, which is very, very important. It's a key theme that Miyazaki himself has been very keenly promoting over the past 3-4 decades now.
And what's his influence continuing to be like in Japan? Is he quite involved in terms of younger filmmakers? Is he finding that he's trying to be a bit of an inspiration for young Japanese filmmakers who indeed could potentially make it in the West?
Well, I mean, this is the interesting thing about his retirement, because one of the reasons he keeps coming back out of retirement is the fact that Studio Ghibli actually doesn't have anyone who can obviously replace him. Now, it's interesting, the last couple of years he's been working with a director called Hideaki Anno, who some of your listeners will know from Neon Genesis Evangelion. And he's worked with Miyazaki on The Wind Rises as one of the voice actors for that, and Miyazaki's then worked with him in turn on a live-action film last year. So there's some talk at the moment that Hideaki Anno might be kind of becoming the Studio Ghibli torchbearer, that he might actually be doing a sequel to Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind, which was Miyazaki's first really big film. He did another one before that, but it's his first really big film from 1984.
Reina, you just said that there is really no one who would continue Miyazaki's work in Japan, but can you see Miyazaki having influenced directors outside of the Japanese borders?
Oh, absolutely. John Lasseter from Pixar is a huge fan of his and has been instrumental in getting him over to America and engaging him with the American publics. So it's not just that he's influenced everyone from John Lasseter to French animators. So there's a huge number of animators who would cite him as an influence. But I think one of the interesting things is how regularly now Pixar and DreamWorks both cite him. And I think you can see that influence in films like Brave and more recent Pixar work as well.
And his latest film, which we played a clip a little earlier, of course, debuted at the Venice Film Festival. Can you give us a sense of his latest film? Has it followed suit to his true style?
Oh, absolutely. Miyazaki has long had an interest in machines, particularly flying machines. He likes ones that are relatively early. So making this film, which is a very reflective film about that Zero plane from the Second World or from the war, is really important to him personally, and I think ties in with a lot of the books he's published on machines and flying machines.
And Reina, just before I let you go, final question: what's your prediction? Do you think this is will this actually be a real retirement, or do you think he may be coming back? Indeed.
Well, he's been doing a lot of script writing lately rather than filmmaking, so I think he'll be back in some capacity. Whether or not he takes on another big film, I'm not so sure. He is 72, and he does deserve some retirement time.
Raina, we're going to have to leave it there. Many thanks for joining us here on the program, Dr. Raina Dennison, on the retirement of Hayao Miyazaki.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Buenos Aires
to Hong Kong
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Toronto
to Amsterdam
to Zurich,
all around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And in the next half hour of the programme, we'll get a tour of new architecture in Belgrade. We'll also get in with our man in Madrid, and David Pleasant will be here to review the Italian newspapers. But first, here is Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
The United Nations says that 2 million people have now fled the conflict in Syria. That's double the number of refugees just 6 months ago. The UN's refugee agency has said it's vital the country's civil war is stopped before it spills over into other nations. Meanwhile, the US Defense Secretary and Secretary of State will lobby Congress today ahead of a vote next week on possible military action against Syria. Microsoft has agreed to buy the mobile phone business of the Finnish company Nokia in a deal worth more than $7 billion. Nokia was once the market leader in mobile phones, but has been struggling in recent years to compete with firms like Apple and Samsung. The deal will see more than 30,000 Nokia employees transfer to Microsoft next year. The Japanese government will spend almost $500 million to secure the Fukushima nuclear plant. It follows confirmation that radioactive water continues to leak from the site more than 2 years after an earthquake and tsunami. Officials have warned the cleanup operation will take decades. Brazil and Mexico have summoned the US ambassadors to the countries over allegations that their leaders have been spied upon. Leaked files suggest the National Security Agency illegally monitored their communications. Brazil says that would be a serious breach of sovereignty. And unions in South Africa say up to 80,000 gold miners are to begin a strike today over pay. They're demanding new recruits get a 60% pay rise, but mine owners have said they can't afford that because of falling gold prices. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul. You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Markus Hippi, and Phil Hahn. In this week's episode of Section D, we'll be paying a visit to Istanbul to investigate the ongoing legacy of one of the Ottoman Empire's most imposing architectural talents. And our Rio de Janeiro correspondent, Sheena Rossiter, meets Israeli architect Nir Sivan to discuss a unique new work he is unveiling in a shopping center in the city.
But in this preview, we are in Serbia. Zaha Hadid is well known for her striking architectural creations around the world. She's done everything from the Aquatic Center at the London Olympics to the Central Building for BMW. But Southeast Europe is new territory for the Iraqi-born architect, and that should change, though, however, in the next few years with the development in the Serbian capital, Belgrade. After 5 years of delicate planning negotiations over the city center site next to the city's ancient fortress, the project is moving on to the next phase.
The company behind the project, Lambda Development, says it has the potential to change the way locals and visitors alike view and enjoy Belgrade. Our correspondent there, Guy Delaney, went to hear their pitch.
Thank you so much for coming. Huge applause, please, to an investor.
Boris Stankobelic. I'm running the local office of Lambda Development in Belgrade, Serbia. This used to be basically the end of the city. Unfortunately, and it used to be, of course, the large textile company headquarters back in the 30s when it was built. We have a port very close by. We have a big warehouse on the river. The river was not exploited in the way it is today, as the contemporary cities do. So what we're trying to do is actually, and it's a trend that the entire city is trying to do, to reform the banks of the river, because we have two amazing rivers, and it's just unbelievable how unused they are. So the first guys that started was the restaurants in the old warehouses, basically, and they made a nice walkway paths, And then there is a plan also for Belgrade port in the future to be refurbished. But this is basically the peak of the peak of the city. This is the place that will connect the city with the river banks, basically, through an amazing project of Zaha Hadid.
Before we get on to Zaha Hadid, I'm interested in the old Beko building, which is, I wouldn't say it's beautiful, but it is old and it's a landmark. What sort of local sensitivities are there to consider before you start doing a new project at a location like this?
The building as a building as itself, doesn't have any architectural value because it was constructed as a factory for military clothes in the 30s. So it's a very simple square building. But today there is a sentiment about the building because it's been sitting here for the last 70 years, obviously, and it has been incorporated in the project. So the rest of the project will connect itself to the building. We will refurbish the building completely. It will be a 5-star hotel, and it will have this industrial look that will be connected with the residential and the commercial spaces here.
All of this is being designed by Zaha Hadid, who of course has been behind all sorts of iconic projects in many cities around the world. And the model of the project in your office looks like something that's been it's all very white. It looks like something that's been carved from a bar of soap. Lots of swooping curves. You're not quite sure where one level starts and the next level begins. What are the details of the design?
Well, it's a good point, because we had the same issue when we were presenting the design. Planners were trying to understand where the building starts from the ground, actually, where is it underground. And the thing with Zaha Hadid is why their design is so amazing, because only a few years ago it started to be possible to actually develop such a projects. The architectural and the construction technique was not developed enough for the construction companies to be able to actually make something like that on the construction site. So finally, thanks to the contemporary methods, we are able to do that construction. And it's very curvy, it's very modern, it's very unusual. It's a landmark.
It's a very fluid shape.
Very fluid, yeah.
It looks like a series of ribbons almost.
Yeah, it's a very fluid shape.
I'm not really sure how these things work. I mean, is a company like Zaha Hadid just for hire, or do they have to be convinced by the idea behind the project in the first place?
Well, when we started working on this 4 or 5 years ago, as you know, it was an economic boom. So at the time, they were not just for hire. They had to actually like the site, they had to like the environment, they have to like the country. And we actually have a couple of people who were born in Belgrade, who moved to London, and they started working with Zaha. And one of the main architects for Zaha Hadid office is also connected with the Belgrade, so they sense the connection, and we convince them to come, to see, to feel the city, to understand why this project is so important to us. So no, they're not just for hire. We had to convince them to come.
The other very prominent construction that's in this area is Kalemegdan, the fortress of Belgrade, which has gone through heaven knows how many incarnations over hundreds, if not thousands, of years. But it is a real landmark of the city. It again links the city to the river. You're going to be right next door with this development. How conscious did you have to be that that's there as well?
Well, it's a good point, because really Kalemegdan is something that's a real, real landmark for the Belgrade. And I would say pretty much the only one, I mean, of that size. And as you said, we are right next to it, so we really had to be very, very conscious about it. We spent a lot of time discussing with the local authorities. They gave us, let's say, directions which to follow in order to combine these two, because this is going to be, I would say, contemporary landmark for the city. But of course, it's not going to jeopardize an old fortress that's next to it. It's two completely different projects, and okay, to to make things really simple, this is going to be a fluid. Calamagnon is very straightforward fortress, so they're not working against each other. I would say that they're working with each other.
That was Monocle's correspondent in Belgrade, Guy Deloney.
You are listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a check-in with our man in Madrid.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, so much more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations, and stunning photography. We look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shiba Ken dog by your side, and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in good bookshops around the world, and is also available to order now at monocle.com. Happy reading!
In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better-run capital. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and asks the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
Who governs the city, who owns the city, who has a right to decide what happens in the city?
The bridge becomes an instrument not of moving traffic, but of land development.
There needs to be a voice for the people that says, okay, now we need a library, now we need the green park. These things that are greater than the individual interests.
Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
You are listening to Midori House. The time is 8:41 a.m. here in London. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world.
Joining us on the line from Madrid to talk us through today's top stories is our man there, Liam Aldis. Liam, welcome to the show. I guess there's only really one thing that everyone in Madrid is talking about, and that, of course, is Olympics 2020.
Yeah, that's right. And the city's actually been plastered with advertising on kind of the street or the bus stops. There's also posters saying the dream, everyone's dream. So I don't know if that's stretching a little on behalf of the city council, seeing as public opinion has kind of dropped in support for the Olympics in recent months due to austerity measures. But we'll see how it goes on Saturday. Everyone is talking, as you said.
Can you still say that this project would have lifted the spirit in Madrid?
I think if we do win, I think people will be happy, especially because it's our third time in a row. So the amount of money that has been spent on this is actually ridiculous. And if we lose again, it will actually be quite a negative blow, a really strong blow to the mayor. The mayor's actually quite a divisive figure in Madrid. She's the wife of the ex-prime minister, the most conservative prime minister that Spain ever had. And she kind of inherited the mayor's office. So she was never really voted in, and she's quite divisive. So I think any time there's something controversial in Madrid, she really tries to avoid controversy because she knows public opinion can really swing against her. So if we don't win on Saturday, I think the fallout for her will be the most damaging.
Barcelona Olympic Games quite a few years ago obviously transformed that city pretty much completely. How much expectations are there that if Madrid actually gets the 2020 Games, that would change things?
This is the interesting point, because most of the transformation in Madrid has already occurred. So we've actually already constructed most of the infrastructure projects, the public transport. They only really need to build the stadium in the Olympic Village. And because of that, the organizers of the Spanish Olympic Committee are really billing these games as the low-cost games. The budget is only 1.94 billion euros. And comparing that to Istanbul, which is about 16.8 billion, and Tokyo, which is 4.3 $1.38 billion. It's quite cheap. So this could actually work against us because the Olympics is always seen as a regenerative project and an opportunity for investment. So if there's not much to build, perhaps a lot of companies and countries, which kind of go play hand in hand, will vote against us.
And Liam, you mentioned the other two candidate cities there vying for the 2020 title is Istanbul and Tokyo. But Madrid's bid is in the very capable hands of one man who's had a bit of experience and I guess luck even in steering some previous winning bids.
Yes, the infamous Terence Burns. He actually he's said to have been responsible for the winning bids in Beijing, Sochi, and Vancouver. And he's been really kind of schooling the Spanish Olympic Committee on everything from protocol when the Olympic Committee was here, telling them they couldn't use their phones or text message when they were talking to the Olympic Committee, kind of really kind of simple protocol 101. But the fact that he also had to give the mayor English lessons, he really oversaw her English lessons, is a kind of a telling in the fact that showing that he's really trying to tweak the Olympic bid in every way. But there's also the Spanish Crown Prince has also been really active in trying to swing candidates. The Prince of Denmark recently complained that the Spanish Prince was calling him all the time and he just wouldn't give up. So you can really see behind the scenes he's working the phones and he's in Buenos Aires at the moment fraternizing with IOC members. So perhaps that will make a difference, but we'll see if it makes the final difference on Saturday.
Liam, let's also discuss the latest movements of Spanish public broadcasters. Supposedly, there are nowadays less soap operas on the television and more business advice.
Yeah, it's music to my ears because the quality of Spanish television is kind of on par with Italy. If you look at kind of the format, and a lot of that has to do with Italian ownership of some of the stations here, but also the fact that they really love their celebrity TV shows, the typical panel talking about celebrities over and over again, repeating the same images over and over again, and really contribute nothing to public discourse, especially in a time of crisis. So the public broadcaster has actually really suffered a dramatic drop in its budget and also in its audience share. The budget's been cut by 20% this year, and audience share has actually dipped below the 10% mark. So producers have actually been quite scared. So they've actually cancelled a show called Corazón, which means heart, which was a typical celebrity TV show, and they've replaced it with a show called Entre Todos, which is kind of a show which is billed as an entrepreneurship show, which is meant to help entrepreneurs or people in need. They have a panel instead of celebrity commentators. They have a panel of experts like lawyers and business advisors and try to help them get their businesses off the ground or even help someone in need. I actually watched a bit of the show, and it is kind of tailoring itself to the audience. It's not a complete show which is going to revolutionize business in Spain. It's still aware of the fact that a lot of its audience at 4 o'clock in the afternoon are older people. So there is a bit of a move to kind of pluck the heartstrings. And I saw a lady who was actually in need of physiotherapy, and she was crying out for help from doctors, and people were calling in to give her help. So it's not all about business, but it is on the right track.
Do you know how much feedback Spanish public broadcaster has got? Are there many Corazon fans who are gutted?
Liam is one.
They can cry into the other channels, I think. But I don't know. I think the show itself was a complete failure, so I don't think actually had many people watching it, so that's why they cancelled it. There's so many of those shows on the other channel, so hopefully, especially when you consider that it's public money, the public money should be being used for something productive, at least contributing back to society, helping people in need, rather than just spending millions of euros on people talking about the bikini of so-and-so, one of the royal family members, on the Mallorcan beach. It really doesn't make sense.
And Liam, finally, a third story which has got your attention. Of course, we've spoken quite a bit about the corruption scandal engulfing the Rajoy government. We haven't spoken, though, in a couple of weeks about it, but it seems like someone is taking a bit of a sabbatical over to Miami.
Yes, she's Carme Chacon. She's actually an aspiring leadership candidate for the Socialist Party. She actually lost the ballot for the leadership by only 22 votes not very long ago. And if you look at the panorama of Spanish politics at the moment, we've got the Catalan independence issue rearing its head again on the 11th of September with the La Diada, which is the famous kind of Catalan National Day. So that's going to be in the news soon as well. We've got corruption scandals engulfing both the ruling party and the opposition as well in the south. We've got a spying scandal engulfing the Socialist Party that actually were found to have wiretapped a hotel where an opposition leader was staying, and we've got all this kind of chaos. And Carmen Chacon has decided to take a sabbatical, and she's announced that she's going to Miami to teach for a year. She's abandoning her seat in Congress, and saying that she'll be back in a year, just in time for the primaries, which is the Socialist Party is enacting next year. So a lot of people are criticizing her move, saying it's a tactical move. She's actually just abandoning ship at a time of chaos. And it really is at odds with her moves to renew the party. She actually had a strategy of party renewal and generational reform within the party. And a lot of her critics within the party have been quoted with saying that they're perplexed and really displeasured by her move, that if she really wants to renew the party, it would make sense for her to do it from Spain, not from a university post in Miami.
Excellent stuff, Liam. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there, but many thanks for coming here on Midori House. And of course, we'll be speaking to you on Friday, the Friday edition of The Globalist at 6 o'clock in the morning, London time, for a very special edition of that program where we're going to be counting down to that all-important Olympics 2020 decision. And we'll be hearing from you from Madrid. So please, to all our listeners out there, stay tuned for that. But Liam Aldis in Madrid, thanks for joining us.
We are reviewing the Italian newspapers up next. Taking us there is number 12 on the Italian charts. This is Emma with Dimentico Tutto.
And that was the very lovely sounds there of Emma with Dimentico Tutto.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Marco Sippi and Phil Hahn. To go through the Italian papers, we are joined in the studio by Monocle's David Pleasant. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Marcus.
You
hello,
quite
Phil.
A few papers in front of you. Where do you want to start?
Well, I thought I'd start with La Repubblica, that has a quite interesting feature on the kind of military situation within the Mediterranean, very relevant to Italy, obviously. The headline is the Mare Nostrum, which is the Latin word for the Mediterranean, RC, is strategic towards the Syrian raid, but also hosts certain potential for retaliation. So it puts Italy in a kind of vulnerable position, basically. As always, the Mediterranean is very important geopolitical place, clearly. Interestingly, Italy has the most American bases just about anywhere. Well, certainly in the Mediterranean. It hosts 8 American naval bases, and also the center of command for operations within Europe of the Americans are in Naples. Yet more kind of evidence of how Italy is going to be embroiled in the Syria crisis, whether it chooses to partake or not.
I think it's interesting that there are as many as 8 American bases in Italy. What's the background for?
Well, obviously it stems from the Second World War. Italy was invaded by the Americans and the British Allied forces, and basically just the Americans kind of stayed ever since. Politically, there has been some problems over Italy hosting these bases. In times like this, with problems in the Middle East, that kind of presence is questioned.
And in the past week, the Americans have doubled their naval presence in the eastern Mediterranean. There isn't really any concern, though, that if there was a Syrian retaliation, there's no kind of concern from Italian authorities that their kind of bases in Italy could be a target.
I don't think so. Certainly not as much as with the Libyan crisis. If you look on the map, Libya is, you know, right opposite Italy. And Libya has threatened in the past, over the last decades, Libya did threat to attack Italy. Italy directly with missiles and so on. So it's not quite that serious. It's more of a kind of geopolitical kind of positioning of Italy. But there is certainly no question that Syria has the missile capability to strike out towards Western Europe.
And what's been the reaction from Prime Minister Letta about the conflict in Syria? Of course, we know that the French, Hollande, has been very adamant in terms of intervening, but he's essentially been left out in the cold by the Americans, who are now going to be waiting until they get congressional authorization. What's the Italian leader been saying in all of this?
Last week, Emma Bonino, the foreign minister, stated very, very clearly that they, she and her ministry are very much against intervention at this stage. Whether they are going to help or aid in terms of allowing the Americans to use their bases, that's probably that's unsaid at the moment. But one would imagine that they would have to, as kind of partners in NATO and as hosts of these bases, they would have to let the Americans go through.
Before we run out of time, do you want to go through another story?
Yep, sure. I thought I'd end with this from La Stampa, Turin's daily paper. Apparently, TV dramas have led to a boom in the study of medicine. Really dramatic figures over the last year, one 20% rise in students deciding to do a medicine degree. But that causes some problems.
If you're saying that's thanks to television, aren't Italians a bit late? I remember ER being in Finnish television, 15 years ago?
ER and also things like House, which is called Doctor House in Italy. This is having a kind of maybe a gradual influence on their aspirations to become kind of sexy doctors.
So people want to be doctors, but they don't want to be pharmacists anymore? Is that what they're saying?
Exactly. There's been a direct fall. As medicine has gone up, there's been a comparable fall in the number of degrees in pharmacy. So too many doctors and not enough pharmacists. So everyone just wanting to play doctor, but not having the drugs to prescribe.
Do you think that's going to actually increase the salaries when it comes to pharmacists or something to get some more incentive?
Good point. And it actually says that it's never been a more appealing degree to do, just because there's that need. Whereas if you take the kind of oversupply of doctors, especially if you're in the south of Italy, you're less likely than ever to actually find a job once you've graduated in medicine.
Thank you very much. That was Monocle's David Pleasant with the Italian papers.
You know, I've always wanted to play doctor. Maybe there's still time, who knows. Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Danny Giacopelli, our researcher, Henrietta Lendels and Gaia Lutz, and our studio manager was Chris Fitch.
Up next after the news is Monocle's weekly business show, The Entrepreneurs, and then an hour of music with Georgina Godwin.
I'll be back with Dominic Reynolds for Midori House at the same time tomorrow, but from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Marco Sippi. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.